Chapter 18. Each time there is a dip in the pavement, she signals by tugging at his arm. Each time he lifts one foot into the air and then puts it down, she can feel his anxiety. Once they've made their way out of the dark alleys, she stands in front of the pedestrian crossing of the two-lane road, her arms still supporting the Greek teacher, and looks around in all directions. They have to find a pharmacy. The one opposite has its shutters down. There isn't much traffic here, making it hard to hail a taxi. The local buses arrive less frequently once the evening rush hour is over. As she used to do whenever her child was taken ill, she coolly and quickly arranges the order of business. There's a deep cut in his right hand. Dust and dirt cover the gash. She had bound his wrist with her handkerchief in order to lessen the bleeding. Already more than half the handkerchief is soaked with blood. Small fragments of glass might be embedded in the cut, so she had been wary of applying pressure to stop the bleed or wiping the blood too thoroughly. She looks at his profile. She looks at the darkness of the tarmac that his unsteady gaze is moving over. His face looks unfamiliar without his glasses, probably because of his eyes, which are larger than she had guessed them to be. And the expression on his face as he struggles to conceal his terror and bewilderment. She takes hold of his uninjured left hand and draws it to her. Breathing in, she uses the tip of her trembling index finger to write distinctly on his palm. First, to the hospital. Chapter 19. A Conversation in Darkness.
Would you switch on the desk lamp? The incandescent over the table is better than the ceiling light. It's actually harder to see if it's too bright.
She removes her shoes and enters the room. It is a frugally decorated studio. There is a metal-framed single bed and a mattress with a dark blue cover, next to a desk made of knotty cryptomeria and a bookcase about a meter wide. Plain mugs, brass rice bowls, and small dishes are neatly arranged on the rack above the sink. A small slim fridge for single-person homes stands next to it. She walks into the room as far as the desk, where five or six books lie open with their corners overlapping. She switches on the light brown shaded desk lamp that sits next to a magnifying glass. As she returns to the entrance, he reaches out his hand and feels along the wall. He lowers the switch for the fluorescent ceiling light she had turned on a moment ago. He flicks the switch below that one, and a yellow light falls from the incandescent lamp suspended over the kitchen table.
You don't have to hold on to me now. Ah, you put my bag down here. It's fine. I just need to know where it is. I won't bump into or trip over things here. You needn't worry.
She had grabbed his bag from the spot by the shoe cupboard where she'd left it. Now she puts it back down. Her black blouse is damp from the humidity that has persisted into the night. Her hair, which has come loose and lies disheveled around her shoulders, is also full of sweat. His white shirt is completely soaked at the back. The scattered drops of blood over his chest have now dried dark. His tightly bandaged right hand hangs at his side. Their arms and faces are slick with sweat.
Would you care to sit on the bench by the window? It's the coolest spot in the room. I actually sleep there when it's very hot.
She walks over to the wooden bench, long enough to lie down on if you curl up a little. She sets her bag on it instead of sitting down herself. Standing against the chair, she watches him walk directly over to the bed without stumbling and sit down on it. A little while ago, in the taxi, he had guided them with similar ease.
After the crossroads, please take the first alley on the left. It's the building right after the By the Way convenience store.
When the taxi stopped, he asked her in a low voice,
"Is it the building right after the By the Way?"
In lieu of an answer, she had briefly laid her hand on his arm.
I'm sorry I don't have a fan. I try not to accumulate belongings.
As though he has no idea what else to say now that they are sitting at a distance, he looks ill at ease. He gazes over in her direction, then raises his unbandaged left hand and points at the fridge.
Would you like a glass of water? I have bottled water in the fridge. No, stay where you are. I'll get it. Though I won't be able to pour it into a cup, my right hand being as it is.
He stands up from the bed and moves over to the fridge, opens the door with his left hand, reaches into the top compartment for two small bottles of mineral water, and tucks them under his right arm. She moves to come and help.
No, don't trouble yourself. I can do it.
He approaches her with careful footsteps. With his left hand, he removes one of the bottles from under his right arm and holds it out to her. Still standing, she takes it.
If I had my glasses, I could have made some iced coffee. I have a younger sister who rarely has a good word to say about her brother. She does approve of my iced coffees, though. She's in Germany now. She sings in a vocal ensemble. She's had the longest career of the sopranos.
He sits on the bed, she on the bench, each of them holding a bottle of water. She looks at the veneer wood flooring, at the shadows the furniture casts on it. When she looks up at the ceiling, she sees there two black shadows on its rice color wallpaper, swollen surprisingly huge. She is suddenly aware of the chirring of insects coming from outside the window. It is similar to the sound she hears on the narrow street along the motorway to her house. All that's missing is the shriek of vehicles that slices into her ears like blades on ice.
This feels strange. Earlier, when we were at the hospital, I didn't mind talking to myself like this. Perhaps because you would occasionally write answers on my palm.
He extends his left hand into the air, then quickly pulls it back onto his lap. Three vertical lines resembling the Hanja for stream form between his eyebrows as he tries to bring something of the blur in front of him into focus.
In the emergency ward, I could hear a lot of different sounds simultaneously. An elderly woman seemed to have burned herself. A child around 3 years old, was crying its heart out. Someone was yelling incoherently in the background. I heard a doctor speak very rudely to a patient, and in Panmal at that.
She recalls those people. She had seen each of them with her eyes. An old woman with gray-streaked hair had the burns. She'd said a medical pad she was using on her knee had suddenly burst into flames. A 3-year-old child had had the top joint of his index finger severed. The young mother had brought the grain-sized tip wrapped in a gauze cloth. But the nurse had told her,
"I'll put this on ice for you, but you have to go to a big hospital. We don't have any doctors here who can do the surgery."
As her exhausted child clung to her back, the mother, unaware of her own tears, had nodded vigorously.
"I understand. Quickly. Please get it ready quickly."
While that hasty exchange was going on, a middle-aged woman's wails could be heard coming from the treatment room near the entrance, where she was having her stomach pumped. It was impossible to make out the words, given the tube inserted into her throat. A young doctor had been incredibly offensive. He'd sneeringly said to the patient,
"See what you got yourself into?"
I never imagined I would end up indebted like this.
She unscrews the lid of the water bottle and takes a sip, rests for a moment, then takes another sip. She listens to the churring outside the window, listens to the abrupt silences that turn out to be Sizuri.
"I don't know how I can repay you."
He frequently lapses into reticences, as though finding it difficult to carry on the conversation by himself.
"They don't know at the academy that my eyesight is this bad. It wasn't strictly necessary for me to inform them, so I never mentioned it. And so..."
He breaks off. She looks at the telegraph pole outside the dark window. The densely tangled black cables keep their peace, concealing the high voltage current that runs through them. He likely wanted to say, "And so, I would be grateful if you don't tell anyone,"
only to realize it was a pointless request to make of her.
Up until now, I've been able to get by somehow or other as long as I have my glasses. What's to come is less certain.
She feels that his pauses and the insect's stridulations are forming a delicate syncopation.
Prick, prick.
A keen sound, like a high note dragged out by an inexpert bow, follows his voice. Now a hush abruptly wedges itself in again. And this time, the shaky string note is the first to sound.
When I first understood that my eyesight would at some point worsen significantly, I asked my mother if everything around me would go pitch black. When really, it was my father I should have asked, as it was his side that had the bad eyes. Father, grandfather, and great-grandfather all. But my father was an indifferent man. And my mother, someone who endeavored to answer any question as best she could.
She holds her breath, then slowly releases it. For the face of her own mother, as it looked at the end, has risen up in her mind. During those final 13 hours, her mother had breathed sluggishly, eyes and mouth half open. Her elder brother and his wife, who had emigrated to Argentina around a decade previously, had caught a flight via Los Angeles and were somewhere above the Pacific Ocean. She whispered into her mother's ear without rest. The hospice staff had advised her to recount stories to her mother, had said her hearing was alive, even if she seemed unconscious. As for which story to tell, she didn't have a choice in the matter. It had to be of the summer afternoon long ago, when her whole family had played water games. The yard of their old Hanok house, the ground covered in a thin layer of cement, the transparent stream of water shooting from the hose. Her father and elder brother collecting the water in a metal bucket with swift movements. Herself, at 7 years old, soaked from head to toe, running about yelling. Her mother, screaming with laughter like an impish young woman, as though 20 years had suddenly fallen from her, hurling bowls of water at her husband and children. She moistened her mother's black lips with a wet flannel and tilted the water bottle to her own dry lips, whispering all the while. When she thought to herself that she couldn't carry on any longer, she whispered faster. When she eventually fell silent, it happened. A bird-like thing abruptly departed the body, and the body was no longer her mother.
Mom, where have you gone?
The question lodged itself in her throat as she sat there blankly, not even thinking to close the body's eyelids.
And my mother told me no. She said it would be both bright and dark, that everything would just get very hazy. I could make a rough guess as to what that would be like, as, with my right eye closed, everything I saw with my bad left eye was already quite blurry. My little sister heard this and ran into the kitchen. She rummaged around in the cupboard for a translucent plastic bag and held it up against her eyes. She said, "Well, there's the sofa, and there's the bookcase. That's white, and that's orange. Look, I can walk around without tripping over anything." Our mother snatched the plastic bag out of my fascinated sister's hand with a withering look.
He tilts the bottle to his lips, happily gulps down the water. She sees the soft generosity that his face reveals, the tenderness occasioned by remembering his flesh and blood. His dark, hardened face relaxes, brightens a little.
Our mother was strict and intimidating. She didn't tolerate anyone teasing me about my sight. But my little sister had been truly relieved for me in that moment. She'd just discovered that her father's near future and her brother's distant future wouldn't be as awful as she'd thought. But my mother was too serious a person to understand that.
She listens to him without giving any indication that she is listening. She soon realizes that something, perhaps something akin to a bird, is living within the contours of his face, and that the warmth of it awakens an immediate pain in her.
Are you listening?
He is uneasy all of a sudden, clutching the half-empty bottle in his left unbandaged hand. He reaches out,
and sets it down on the desk next to the bed.
Don't you have to go? Won't your family be worried?
Her face darkens briefly. She has remembered playing hide-and-seek with her cousins when she was young. At the house of her father's younger brother, in their tiny village full of people with the same family name. She had been blindfolded with a handkerchief, and her cousins hid. Stretching out her hands to grab a presence that felt just out of reach, she heard muffled laughter. After searching the empty air for a while, she suddenly felt a chill and stopped short. She removed the covering from her eyes and examined the rooms, the doors of which had been flung wide open, and discovered that all her cousins had disappeared outside.
Are you listening over there?
The light goes out in his face, too. The warm bird curls into a ball and hides. She wavers, then carefully moves her feet and knees to make her presence known. Sets the water bottle she has been holding down on the chair. He hesitates before starting on the next story. Fixes his gaze in the direction of her face, which he cannot see.
When I left my mother and sister in Germany to come to Seoul, I booked a one-way ticket. I did consider getting a round-trip ticket with an open return date, but for some reason I didn't want to.
He moistens his lips with the tip of his tongue. He leaves long pauses between one sentence and the next. Similar to how someone writing in the dark tries to leave a wide margin between lines, so the sentences written above and below won't overlap.
The plane flew eastward, eastward, on the westerlies. Each time I looked out of the window, we seemed to be riding on an enormous arrow. But an arrow speeding not toward any target, but toward what lay outside it.
Slowly, carefully, she moves her foot to make a sound.
Half the passengers were Germans, the other half were Koreans. A Korean air hostess, the only one, asked me in Korean, "What would you like to drink?" And I laughed. I realized that on that flight, I was no longer conspicuous.
He picks up the water bottle and wets his lips.
When we first moved to Frankfurt, my mother was constantly on edge. As foreigners, especially as conspicuous East Asians, she was adamant that we should not make any missteps. It was a compulsive, obsessive anxiety. When we went out on the weekends, she would squabble with my father over the most trivial thing.
"And what happens if we drive down and there's no casa at the exit? So what if it's far? We know for sure there's one on the first floor, so let's go back and make sure our parking fee's all paid up. Listen, we're foreigners here. They'll think we're trying to get past without paying. Well, I'm saying, what if there's no casa at the exit? No, it's not okay. Why take the risk?"
A bitter smile rises to his lips.
Compared with my father, who went on brusquely repeating that it was fine and she shouldn't worry, my mother's fretting did seem excessive. But looking back at it now, for the most part, she had it right. There were instances here and there of discrimination and unfair treatment, though they weren't always explicit. At the school my sister and I attended, at the German companies and government offices my father dealt with, looks of barely concealed, icy disdain and contempt that couldn't be called anything but a racial gaze.
When his silences become drawn out, she makes a small movement to signal her presence. Sweeps her hand across the armrest of the wooden chair, or sweeps up her hair, then becomes still again.
Our mother was permanently exhausted. After we moved to Mainz so that she could provide for us when our father no longer could, she opened a shop selling Asian groceries, and we practically never saw her smile at home. She'd grumble to us. "How is it each time you meet a stranger's eye in this country, you're supposed to smile? I'm done with smiling. I won't do it anymore. Let me live as I want. I'd rather not smile, at least not in my own home. But don't mistake that for anger. I may not smile, but that doesn't mean I'm angry."
It takes only a small movement to make her shadow on the ceiling lurch, magnified. The slightest tremor in her face and hands sets the shadow astir as though dancing.
As a teenager, I myself struggled with smiling, having to act all cheerful and confident. Always having to be ready with a greeting or a smile was exhausting. Sometimes simply saying hello and smiling felt like labor. Then, there were days when I felt I couldn't endure a second more of people smiling just for the sake of it. And so I'd risk being stereotyped as another Oriental martial arts thug and pull my cap down low, stuff my fists in my pockets, and walk around with the most unfriendly expression I could manage.
Their magnified shadows on the ceiling suddenly stop moving. Soundlessly, firmly cleaving to their black borders, they remain apart.
Eventually, the plane landed at Incheon Airport, and I disembarked with a smile. A smile I had practiced and honed for so long, it was by then as good as my own. When my body came in close proximity to someone else's, I felt like saying, "Excuse me," in German. When my eyes met someone else's, I felt like smiling. But as I walked out of arrivals, it hit me. Shouldering my way through the crowd of Koreans waiting for their family and friends, I realized I wasn't conspicuous. Not here. Not anymore. And that I was finally, safely back in the folds of a culture where people aren't expected to exchange smiles or greetings with every passing stranger. I couldn't understand why this caused such a wrenching sense of solitude in me then.
She feels the churring outside the window as a needle piercing the hush of the room, boring countless imperceptible holes into a charged silence that is as taut as fabric caught in a tambour. The shadows remain impassive. She stifles even her breathing. His face is pallid, frozen.
That reminds me of our first winter in Germany, when the three of us, minus our father, went on a train journey to Italy.
His monologue speeds up in increments, as when a page is marred by hasty scribbles done in the dark. Line overlaying line, ink overlaying ink, memory overlaying memory.
I don't remember much, not clearly. Not anything else we saw in Italy. Not the artwork, the churches, the food. The only thing I can't forget are the catacombs. It was a city of the dead. Each passage forked off in three different directions. The stories about the tourist who lost their way and died of starvation made sense then. The walls of the stone chambers were made up of tombs shaped like different sized drawers. The Korean tour guide accompanying us on our trip asked, "Can anyone guess why there are no remains to be seen in these tombs?" My sister, with her carrying voice, answered, "Because they've been taken to a museum?" The guide said that was incorrect. "Someone stole them?" another tourist suggested, and the guide again shook her head. "They're all here," the guide said, almost proudly. "If you did a chemical analysis of the earth that lies in these tombs, right here in front of you, you'd find large amounts of calcium and phosphorus. After thousands of years, this is what a person's bones become."
She turns to look out of the window. In the darkness, the electric cables remain snarled, sunk in an untroubled stillness, even as they allow voices, images, countless blinking letters and characters to flow into the high-voltage current.
I thought I might vomit. Out of terror at the earth in front of me, afraid it would get on my body. But I couldn't run. It was too dark. Everywhere I looked, the same three-pronged passage lay before me.
"I thought I might vomit," she mumbles from a place deeper than tongue or throat. Some months ago, she had spent several days vomiting at two-hour intervals. This was right after she'd lost custody of her child. When she brought her son home a week later, she somehow managed to make a favorite dish of his, omurice. Then she herself ate nothing but cabbage for the rest of the evening. Either pureed in the blender or steamed in a pan. There was nothing else her insides would tolerate.
"You're going to turn into a rabbit, Mom," her child said. "Your whole body will go green."
She laughed along, then went to the toilet to vomit again. Rinsing out her mouth, soured with stomach acid,
She came out of the toilet and teasingly asked, "Why don't rabbits turn green when all they eat is grass?"
"Because," her child said, "rabbits eat carrots too."
Fighting down the nausea, she laughed.
Talking by myself like this and at such length, I'm strangely reminded of that moment, of how we were gathered there, our bodies still holding all their warmth, inside that enormous tomb where thousands of what were once such bodies had entirely disintegrated away. Even the bones.
Ink overlays ink. Memory overlays memory. Bloodstain overlays bloodstain. Serenity over serenity. Smile over smile. Bears down.
I'm exhausted.
He is silent for a while.
I feel I may not wake up for several days if I sleep now.
He is feeling for something with his hands, teeth clenched. He goes over the same spot twice, as she does when she moves her hands over the ice of silence. When one layer of ice melts, a three-pronged road will be waiting, and beneath another layer of ice, another three-pronged road, and beneath yet another, thicker layer of ice, another road, branching off endlessly.
There was this one time when I really didn't wake up for days. Someone had hit me in the face with a block of wood. Not some unknown assailant. It was someone I knew very well. My glasses shattered and I was badly cut. I still have the scar.
Her gaze touches the faint line that runs from the corner of his eye to the corner of his mouth. She realizes, now that the night has grown as deep as it will get, the tenuous stridulation is about to cease for good. There is only the black darkness swaying in and out of countless windows flung open in the sweltering night, and in and out of countless finely meshed mosquito screens, like ghosts.
I was completely unconscious for some time, and when I woke up, I was in a hospital room. A shared room, but the other two beds were empty. I looked over at the darkened windows and thought, is it about to get lighter now or darker?
That instant, the memory of a long-lost word rises up in her, cut in half, and she tries to grab hold of it. She had learned that, in times past, there had been a word, a Hanja word beginning with ho, by which people had referred to the half-light just after the sun sets and just before it rises. A word that means having to call out in a loud voice, as the person approaching from a distance is too far away to be recognized, to ask who they are. A word whose derivation is similar to the Western expression, the hour of dogs and wolves. A word beginning with ho. This eternally incomplete, eternally unwhole word stirs deep within her, never reaching her throat.
My mother and sister had just come into the ward. They took one look at me and cried out. My sister ran off to call the nurse. A junior doctor with unkempt hair, worn out by her day, caught up with me. By then, the dark blue light had turned black.
When she was young, she had woken from a long nap and crawled on her knees to the door. It was the door that led to the dark old-style kitchen. She went down the stairs on her bottom and, when she landed on the kitchen floor, she saw her mother squatting in front of the paraffin cooker, making black beans and soy sauce. In vague confusion, she asked,
"Mom, is it tomorrow?"
Her mother burst out laughing. The darkness permeating every corner of the kitchen was that of night. It was a deeper, more solid darkness than the dark of dawn. And on some level, she had sensed this, which is why she'd wondered if it was tomorrow.
The doctor told me I had been unconscious for 3 days, and that no one knew why, given that the external trauma had not been serious.
A faint, oddly melancholy smile forms on his face.
That was the first and the last time I slept so deeply, without even dreaming.
Quietly, as water stains a dry board, the smile spreads across his face.
in time.
His voice wanes.
I will see only when I dream.
At a certain point, he seems to have forgotten whom he is speaking to. He seems to be addressing someone who isn't here.
A rose. The inner red of a watermelon, blooming like a flower when you split it open. The night of Buddha's birthday. Snowflakes. The face of a woman long gone. I won't be waking from a dream and opening my eyes. The world is what will close when I wake from a dream.
Fatigued, she closes her eyes for a long moment before opening them again. That she is here, now, does not feel real. When she closes her eyes again, her consciousness tries to ebb away from her waking life. If she were to open her eyes now, she might see the ceiling of her own living room. She might have been asleep all this time, curled up in her usual spot on the living room sofa. Several hours ago, during the 30 or so minutes when she had waited in the empty classroom for the lesson to begin, she had felt a similar confusion. The Greek lecturer, who always arrived early and waited for the students, hadn't appeared for some reason. Nor had any of the other students, not the middle-aged man who favored the spot behind the pillar, nor the postgrad near the window, who liked to expel the sharp-edged Greek words through his teeth, nor the young philosophy student, who looked at her with blinking, curious eyes. The blackboard, the platform in front of the blackboard, the students' desks, all stood empty. The two fans were unmoving, angled toward opposite walls, as though avoiding each other. The empty desks and chairs, where the students usually stood or sat lively and animated, chatting with each other when they weren't talking on their phones, burrowed into her eyes, charged with a strange, aching sensation. She had squeezed her eyes tight. Time as it was for her seemed out of joint with how it was for everyone else. Sharply dislocated, like a fault line in a rocky crag, so that the two temporalities might never again coincide. Blankly listening to the muffled sound of traffic, she had packed her textbook, notebook, and cloth pencil case back into her bag. Leaving the lights on in the silent classroom, she had walked out into the dark corridor, her shoes ringing out unusually loudly against the floor.
Are you listening over there?
His voice sounds transformed, like something coming out of a speaker muffled by damp air. With her eyes closed, she doubts whether the voice is that of the Greek lecturer. Does it match the voice she's heard these many months in the desolate classroom? Had that voice been so frail? So tremulous?
Do you ever wonder at the strangeness of it? That our bodies have eyelids and lips? That they can at times be made to close from the outside? And at other times, to lock fast from within.
Laboriously raising her heavy eyelids, she recalls, as if in a brief sleep, the alleyway in front of her old house, where the sun used to set. She and her young mother had been on their way to see her mother's parents. "Let's stop at the market and buy tangerines," she heard her mother say. She had been struggling to zip up her coat, but at these words, bright orange tangerines appeared before her eyes. She was amazed they weren't real, that she wasn't actually seeing them when they looked so delicious. She hurriedly thought of something else. Trees. But the same thing happened. It was like magic. In front of her lay only the darkening alleyway and the seemingly endless stretch of concrete wall. And yet she was quite clearly looking at a tree. The shapes of letters she'd only just learned began to superimpose themselves over the tree. Na, mu. Saying the word out loud, she laughed to herself. Na mu, na mu. Tree.
Does it sound strange to you, all this I'm saying?
She opens her eyes and looks at his face. She sees the old scar and the new smudge of dust from when he ran his hand over it earlier. She closes her eyes again.
sees the boyish face she'd seen in him moments ago rise up, intact, in that same magic she'd experienced as a child.
If you don't mind, there's something I'd like to ask. Truly, I hope you won't be offended.
His voice falls.
That is, have you always been unable to speak?
The ceiling is covered with plain rice-colored wallpaper, and the books in the bookcase are completely still. The sound of crickets has died away. The only things bruising the silence in the shadowy room are the engine sounds coming from afar. Wind enters through the open window, a sodden wind, like a wet towel. She feels the urge to pass a cold towel over her face, which is sticky now that the sweat has dried. The urge to wipe away the new smudge on his face.
What sort of work do you do?
She stares at his searching eyes, his tense lips, his jaw, and the edges of his cheeks, where a bluish shadow has begun to emerge as the night wears on. As though, hidden within the strokes and dots that make up his face, there are marks or pictographs that she needs to decipher. As though she has only to render that face as a drawing with a few strokes for some quiet words to be revealed. Early in the spring of her second year in high school, she had written a few poems with the title, Pictograph. She wrote in the hope of conveying an understated humor, the small A of the Roman alphabet as an exhausted person with her head and shoulders slumped forward. The Hanja for light, Guang. A shrub, rooting down underground, as overground it rises toward the light. The echoic, ooh, ooh, ooh. The sound of rumbling shouts. A row of raindrops along a window ledge rolling off as one. Or tears that well up and trickle down from under one's lashes. Bright, quiet, naive poems she never showed to anyone. But the poems she wrote sometime later were different. Little by little, her words began to falter and trail off, finally breaking into fragmented units or decaying into formlessness, like flesh that had fallen away.
Why are you studying Greek?
Off her guard, she looks down at her left wrist. Beneath a dark purple hairband, which is damp with sweat, the old scar is also clammy. She will not remember. And if she must remember, if it is absolutely unavoidable, she will not feel anything. Eventually, without feeling, as though remembering a distant acquaintance, she recalls that day.
You're insane.
The person had spat at her from the dark when she regained consciousness.
All this time, I let a crazy bitch look after my child.
Short-tongued and shallow-throated words. Loose words. Words that slipped and slashed and stabbed, metallic, filled her mouth. Before they fell, woo, soo, soo, out of her mouth, like the splintered pieces of a razor blade, before she was able to spit them out, they had first wounded her.
That day, what did you write in Greek in your notebook?
She brushes her fingers over her lips as though touching a huge abraded saw. As though remembering a long atrophied organ, she searches in her mind for the root by which words had once shakily gushed out. She knows that no single specific experience led to her loss of language. Language worn ragged over thousands of years, from wear and tear by countless tongues and pens. Language worn ragged over the course of her life, by her own tongue and pen. Each time she tried to begin a sentence, she could feel her aged heart, her patched and repatched, dried up, expressionless heart. The more keenly she felt it, the more fiercely she clasped the words. Until all at once, her grip slackened. The dulled fragments dropped to her feet. The saw-toothed cogs stopped turning. A part of her, the place within her that had been worn down from hard endurance, fell away like flesh, like soft tofu dented by a spoon. Could not be reconciled.
The things not to be reconciled with were everywhere. And the body of a homeless person found dead on a park bench beneath several layers of newspaper on a bright spring day. And the dull eyes of people riding the subway late at night, all looking off in different directions as they stood shoulder to sweat-gummed shoulder. And the line of vehicles on the motorway, their endless trail of taillights in torrential rain. And the procession of days, each day nicked and torn open by numerous skate blades. And human bodies, so easily crushed. In the exchange of foolish, clipped jokes that are meant to make us forget all. In the words we press onto paper so as to not forget a single thing. And in the foul stench of the gas bubbling up out of those words before we know it. Occasionally, after a long period of solitude or illness, in the early hours before dawn or late into the night, extraordinarily clean, serene words did flow out of her, quite unexpectedly, as though she were speaking in tongues, but she could not believe that this was proof of her reconciliation. Fatigue is like a heady intoxication dulling her thoughts. His voice sounds like something in a dream, arriving as if from a great distance in broken fragments.
There are moments when I think I get it, when I feel I understand you. There are moments when I want to stop talking.
She makes an effort to look at his face, to look steadily into his unfocused eyes.
When I write with white chalk on the dark green blackboard, I am terrified. My own writing, and yet from more than 10 centimeters away, I can't see it. When I read out something I've memorized, I am terrified. The phonemes my tongue and teeth and throat so calmly articulate terrify me. The silence of the space into which my voice travels terrifies me. Words that are irrevocable, that can't be taken back, that are aware of so much more than myself, terrify me.
It occurs to her that she can no longer tell whose words it is she is hearing. Inside this horrible fatigue, in this horribly dim, sedate room, everything feels like an apparition. She has heard nothing. She has glimpsed the inner life of nothing and no one.
There are times when it feels like I'm moving through a fog. Like on winter days in that city when early morning fog would roll in from the lake and smother the town well into the evenings. Like the nights when I had to walk slowly between the gray buildings, my body pressed up against the wet stone walls, their frescoes obscured by the fog. Nights on which no one rode their bikes, and the sound of heavy footsteps was the only sign of other people about. When it seemed no matter how long I walked, I would never reach my cold house.
No matter how much time passes, there are some things she will never be certain of. That day, why did the white dog flattened against the hot tarmac bite her? When that was his final moment, why had he torn at her flesh so forcefully, using all his strength? Why had she tried so foolishly to embrace him until the end?
Can you hear me?
She is listening to him intently. He doesn't know how difficult that is. She is looking at him intently. He doesn't know how difficult that is either. She is looking, with all her strength, at his face, which is nearly half in shadow in the desk lamp's slanting light.
Are you listening over there?
She watches him get to his feet. She watches him approaching her in his white shirt, whose splattered bloodstains have now stiffened into dark brown patches, moving his feet with care. She sees that he is even more exhausted than she is, that he is struggling not to stagger.
I'm sorry. This is the first time I've spoken at such length by myself.
He just about manages to push the fatigue to the back of his face and speak. He bends forward and reaches out his left hand toward her. She looks into his eyes that are no longer behind glasses.
These are eyes that distinguish dark and light. Eyes that are clearly looking at the contours of her face.
Will you write an answer here?
She looks at his eyes that are no longer searching the empty air, but are the eyes of someone who has been speaking alone for a long time. The eyes of someone who has not heard a single answer.
Would you like to call the taxi now?
She moistens her lower lip with the tip of her tongue. She pulls her lips apart, then forcefully presses them back together. Supports his outstretched hand with her left hand, and with the irresolute index finger of her right hand, writes on his palm. No. Strokes and dots, faintly tremulous, brush over their skin simultaneously, then disappear. Soundless and invisible. No lips or eyes. The tremor and the warmth soon vanish. Not a trace remains. I will take the first bus. Chapter 20. Sunspots. He opens his eyes at the sound of heavy rain. It is dark. The window is open. He has to close it, or the rain will keep blowing in. Absent-mindedly groping on the desk next to the bed for his glasses, he recalls the events of the previous night. His right hand is still smarting. He shifts himself off the bed and stands there in his bare feet. He heads toward the window, arms out, toward where the cold rain and wind are coming in. He strains to distinguish between the lighter and the darker darkness. He reaches to the side, to the front, but is still nowhere near the wall. Still nowhere near the radiator or the bench beneath the window. Eventually, he feels the moist air on his face and arms. Droplets of water touch his outstretched hand. Gliding his way over to the window, he finds its aluminum handle. He slams the window shut. Water splashes his hand. The loud sound of rainfall retreats. It doesn't take long for him to realize that the woman is not on the bench. There's no hint of movement or breathing.
Have the buses started running then?
He mutters out loud. His voice sounds hoarse, like it belongs to someone else. He sits on the bench, passing both hands over its length. He discovers that the woman has left the thin quilt and blanket neatly folded. He had fetched them from the chest of drawers the night before. He lies down on the folded quilt. There is the faint smell of sweat and an apple scent. It reminds him of bath soaps for young children. He raises his hands. The whitish thing is the bandage on his right hand. The less whitish thing is his left hand. The warm strokes and dots that had tickled over his left palm, the flesh remembers first. The hand that hesitated, trembling ever so slightly. The fingers whose nails were clipped so short, they didn't hurt his skin at all. The gradually revealed syllables. The full stop like a thumbtack without the pin. The single phrase slowly becoming clear.
You probably wouldn't have guessed, but I've sometimes imagined sharing a long conversation with you. I've imagined you're listening attentively when I speak to you, and vice versa. When we were waiting together in the empty classroom for the lesson to begin, there were times when I felt as though we really were conversing. Then I'd raise my head and find you looking like someone half, no, around two-thirds, no, more broken even than that, as wrecked as a mute object that has barely made it through, a ruin. At times, I feared you. When I conquered that fear, went over to you and sat on a nearby chair, it seemed you would also move closer to me. There were nights when I thought of that frightening silence of yours. A silence entirely different from ours, as ours' silence had felt like an immense pool of undulating light. Yours was like a hand under ice that turned stiff after slamming in vain at the frozen surface. A silence like a snowdrift blanketing a blood-stained body. I was genuinely afraid that your silence would turn to actual death, turn rigid, then glacial.
He opens his eyes and stares out into the darkness. He cannot see a thing. He closes his eyes again, almost in submission, and looks at the darkness behind his eyelids. He gives his body over to the early morning sleep that presses in on him through that darkness, impossible to defy. Hears the rain burrowing into his ears.
If snow is the silence that falls from the sky, perhaps rain is an endless sentence. Words fall onto paving slabs, the roofs of concrete buildings, black puddles, bounce off the ground. Letters of my mother tongue, shrouded in black raindrops. Strokes both rounded and straight, dots fading away. Curled up commas and stooped question marks.
In the dream he slips into as soon as he falls asleep, a dream that is at risk of disintegrating, he sees two people, an old man and a young woman. In a voice made tremulous by old age, the man asks,
"Tell me, what is this smell?"
Pressing his hands together in front of his chest, as though begging forgiveness. The young woman begins to describe it, swiftly, with animation, enthusiasm, and accuracy. In alarmingly bold, casual speech. "It's a forest of oaks. The roots bulge here and there, sticking out of the ground like joints. There's an ivy wound tightly around them."
"What does it look like?"
"Trunks, crooked branches, like they might come for us, actually. Like they'd coil around us quickly and hurl us, but... oh."
"But what? What do you see?"
The old man's voice trembles.
"Don't stay silent like that. Don't hide what's ugly and frightening from me. What's wrong? What's happening?"
His words speed up. His voice grows more tremulous, higher pitched.
"Talk to me, with your lips, your tongue, your throat. Speak. Where are you? Give me your hand, for God's sake, make a sound."
A sharp pain gouges his chest. He cannot catch hold of her hand. That woman's hand, is not here. He cries like a child. His eyes start open, and he discovers that he wept more copiously in the dream than in reality. There are only scant warm tears on his cheeks. Having found no solace, he is sucked down into sleep again. This time, it is not a dream, but a memory. The black bird that had come swooping down. The stairs that had been sunk in darkness. The glow from the flashlight that had pulled at the bottom. The pale glimmer of her approaching face. He starts awake from the memory and enters another dream. This time, he is suddenly able to see clearly. Strangers gathered in the cold depths of a subterranean space. The warm breath billowing out of their mouths. The white ash painted on each of their faces, as though they were corpses or players in a farce. A different dream steals in like a thief, blankets the first. A rather dark stage. People in their seats waiting for a performance. The darkness that, instead of brightening, is growing gradually more deep. The strange, long silence. The performance that never begins. Again the sound of the rain. The darkened face of a woman from the past. Cold raindrops. On the umbrella. On her brown forehead. On her already wet hands. On the bluish veins swollen there. A lucid, beautiful voice he is hearing for the first time speaks German words into his ears. "I told you, didn't I, that someday you yourself would become an impossible fallacy?" A familiar room wrapped in vibrant blue thread. A letter dozens of pages long and composed of bright holes that he must now read. Lying at his side and exuding cold, the indistinct contours of a person who smells of apples. Trembling. Palm.
A full stop. Warm. Black sand. No, firm fruit. In frozen earth. Dug. Buried. Laid to rest. A comma. Curved eyelash. Frail breath. Inside a dark sheath. Inside a shining knife. Waiting a long time with bated breath. He is jolted from sleep. Sits up. Realizes a sound outside his front door was what woke him up. The unlocked door slowly opens. It gets a little brighter in that direction, then darkens again, along with the sound of the door closing. Someone can be heard taking off their shoes. The rain is coming down heavily, but outside the window it is brighter than it was a little while ago. And with some guesswork, he is able to make out the dark contours of a person. Seeing the dark form approaching, he raises his eyes. He scrubs his face vigorously with his unbandaged left hand to remove the sleep. He inhales the distinct scent of soap coming from their hair as they draw nearer. He shivers, as though suddenly cold. Something white reaches out from the black form, takes hold of his left hand, and spreads it open. The other white thing slowly reaches out and writes on his palm. It's time. The opticians will be open. He reads the sentence through touch. Do you have a prescription slip? He nods. It's raining. So I'll go. It's best. He waits some more. Waits for more words. Feels the cold, moist air coming from her face, from her body. The prescription. Where is it? He stands up, carefully disengaging his hand. He means to head to the desk, but abruptly, as though compelled, he moves toward the pale blur of her face, floating there in the dark. Raises his unbearably trembling left arm and brings his hand to her shoulder. He doesn't know that her lips have stiffened as though her mouth has been gagged with transparent tape. He doesn't know that the previous night, she had been unable to sleep either in this room or after returning home on the first bus. He doesn't know that, after showering for a long time with warm water and her child's bubble soap, she had sat at the kitchen table and opened her Greek notebook. He doesn't know that she wrote out dead Greek letters as though feeling her way through dozens of forked roads buried beneath ice, and then, persevering, wrote beside them the unbearably alive phrases of her mother tongue. With both eyes looking out into the darkness, he is still embracing her shoulders. He feels like he is weighing something and mustn't get it wrong. He feels he will surely get it wrong. It is truly frightening. He doesn't know where she was directly before she came here. He doesn't know that she waited outside the school, on this last day, before the start of summer vacation, searching the forest of umbrellas, until eventually recognizing one with a picture of Buzz Lightyear. And her child's shorts visible beneath that, the brown spot imprinted on his knee, the size of a red bean.
Why are you here today? You know tomorrow's our day.
That she stared down at the face of her child, who had whispered this as though he were afraid. That she wiped away the raindrops trickling down his face with the palm of her hand. That she had parted her lips in desperation, to call her child by his name, to say the words she had prepared. You don't have to go far away. You don't have to go anywhere. You can stay here with me. We can run away together. We'll manage somehow. Her shirt is damp with rain and sweat. Leaving his bandaged right hand dangling in the air, he clasps her back a little more firmly with his left arm and hand, drawing her to him. Downstairs, someone bangs a door and stamps along the corridor. He doesn't know that ropes of rain had crashed down onto her umbrella as she stood there in silence. He doesn't know that her bare feet had become drenched inside her trainers.
I told you, Mom, you can't just show up. I told you it's weirder to say goodbye outside.
He doesn't know that the thin, soft flesh slipped away as swiftly as a fish when she moved to hug the boy,
to catch his arm, to hold his hand. He doesn't know that spikes of rain sliced into the black puddles of rainwater like giant needles. The sound of the rain edges in through the closed window. It is loud, strong, forceful enough to dent and fracture roads, buildings. Someone is dragging their feet as they walk down the stairs. Again, a door slams somewhere. With their hearts pressed together, he knows her as little as ever. He doesn't know that a long time ago, when she was a child, she had looked out at the garden as the dusk was gathering, unsure if it was okay for her to exist in this world. He doesn't know the layer of words that was forever bruising her, pricking at her like needles. He doesn't know that his eyes are reflected in hers, that hers are in his reflection, and his again in those, in an endless reflection. He doesn't know how this terrifies her, and how her lips are clenched tightly for that reason, or that her lips are already blood dark from the pressure. In order to find the softest spot on her face, he closes his eyes and feels her face with his cheek. Her cool lips meet his cheek. A photograph he had seen long ago in Joachim's room, a photograph of the sun, flares up behind his closed eyelids. The surface, an enormous burning flame, and over it, dark patches that move. Sunspots, which explode and shift across the sun's surface, themselves reaching thousands of degrees Celsius. Were you to look at them from close up, through however thick a piece of film, your irises would burst. He kisses her mouth without opening his eyes, kisses the damp hair beneath her ears, her eyebrows. Like a faint answer heard from far away, the tips of her cold fingers graze his eyebrows, then vanish. They touch the chilly edges of his ear, the scar that runs from the corner of his eye to his mouth, then vanishes. Sunspots explode without a sound in the distance. Hearts and lips touch across a fault line, at once joined and eternally sundered.
Chapter 21. Deep Sea Forest. We were lying side by side in the woods under the sea then, in a place that had neither light nor sound. You were not visible, and I was not visible. You did not make a sound, and I did not make a sound. Until you made a very small sound, until a tiny, frail bubble emerged from between your lips. We lay there. You were full of yearning. It was frighteningly still. It was dark as the night that nightfall deepens to, as dark as the deep sea where pressure flattens all living bodies. At one moment, moving your index finger over the flesh of my shoulder, you wrote, "Woods," you wrote. "Woods." I waited for the next word. Realizing that no next word was coming, I opened my eyes and peered at the darkness. I saw the pale blur of your body in the darkness. We were very close then. We were lying very close and embracing each other. The sound of the rain did not cease. Something broke inside us. In that place where both light and voice were absent, among slivers of coral that hadn't borne the pressure, our bodies were now trying to float upward. Not wanting to float upward, I wound my arm around your neck. I groped for your shoulder and kissed it. So that I would be unable to kiss you again, you embraced my face and made a small sound for the first time. A sound as thin and frail as a bubble, and round. I stopped breathing. You went on breathing. I could hear you breathing on and on. Then, we slowly floated upward. First, we touched the water's bright surface. Then, we were roughly driven ashore. It was frightening. It was not frightening. I wanted to burst out crying. I didn't want to burst out crying. Before you fell away completely from my body, you kissed me. Slowly. My forehead. My eyebrows. My two eyelids. It felt like I was being kissed by time. Each time our lips met, the desolate darkness gathered. Silence piled up like snow. Snow, the eternal eraser, mutely reaching our knees, our waists, our faces.
Chapter 0. I bring my hands together in front of my chest. I moisten my lower lip with the tip of my tongue. Quietly, swiftly, my hands chafe. My eyelids quiver like stridulating insect wings. I open my lips, which are already dry. I breathe deeper, resolute breaths, in, out. As I speak the first syllable, I close and open my eyes with intention, as if readying myself to discover, upon reopening them, that everything will have vanished. This is Greta Jung. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Greek Lessons, a Novel, by Han Gang, translated by Deborah Smith and Emily Ye Wan. This program was directed by Andrea Kaufman. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Edited by Tim Bader Audio. Translation copyright 2023 by Deborah Smith. Originally published in Korean as 휘라퍼 시간 by Munhak Dongne, Pajushi, South Korea, in 2011. Copyright 2011 by Han Gang. Production copyright 2023, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.